I'm Alex Brenner, and I'm here today interviewing Arthur Snowden. Art, but the way I'd like to start out is just by letting everybody who might be watching or listening know what you did in Alaska and how long you did it.
You want me to do that? I was administrative director of the judicial branch of government from 1973 to 1997, excuse me.
And how many years is that?
24 and a half.
24 and a half years, and that's the only position you held?
That is the only position I held. In the Alaska court system, I hold other positions, president of this organization and that type of thing.
Tell us how, had you ever been to Alaska before you came up for that position?
I never was in Alaska before I came up to interview with the court, no. The court asked me to come up to interview for this position along with two other people. They'd gone on some type of search and had interviewed some people, I imagine, and then culled it down to a few likely suspects and flew us up for an interview.
And was that was your first encounter with Alaska?
My first encounter with both Alaska and most of the members of the court. I had briefly met Justice Boney and Justice Rabinowitz in Charleston, South Carolina. I believe that was where they wouldn't have remembered me, but I was there for a conference, and they were there trying to drum up support to have the Chief Justice's conference come to Alaska.
And this was when?
A couple of years before I came up for the interview. But it had nothing to do with me coming up for the interview. It was just a chance encounter. Justice Boney was talking about Alaska. I really didn't even stay around and listen to him talk about it.
Well, take us back then. Tell us how you got into the position of meeting Justice Boney and then coming to Alaska.
Well, why don't we just start with my childhood and head on upward. How's that? I was born in Connecticut. I was born in Connecticut in the south end of Hartford, a fairly rough area. Had a sister, lived in an eightplex, got my early education in the public elementary schools of Hartford. And my father, who I revere greatly, had quit high school to put my uncle through Yale architecture, sculpture school, School of Fine Arts, whatever they call it. And then my uncle won the Prix de Rome, a very famous scholarship, and went to Rome to study. And my dad went to work on a drill press machine at Pratt & Whitney Aircraft to help pay the bills for all this. And over time, he became a foreman, and over time, he became a head of the assembly and test divisions of Pratt & Whitney Aircraft, and was leading approximately 40,000 men and women in his division. So I was very proud of him. He set very high standards, and I failed to meet any of them. We moved up to West Hartford, which was at that time was the richest town in the United States, and we were the poorest family in the richest town in the United States, where I attended junior high school and high school. And I hated high school. I just couldn't stand it. It was a public school, and it was a good public school. They said it was a very rich town, but I watched how people treated other people. There were cliques, and I got along with most people, but I saw so many people get hurt because they weren't included in this group and that group, and that had a profound effect on me. I just didn't like it, and I decided that I didn't want anything to do with this. So I was going to go off and find a job after high school, just like my father had, and my mother said, no, you're not going to do that. So she filled out all kinds of college applications and said, sign here. And so I signed and went on to college. And
what did your mom do?
My mom was just a mom. She stayed home and worried about me. My sister, no one worried about her. She was a straight A student, and she went to the convent for a while, and she was a perfect person, but I ran with a group that called themselves the Jokers and
A West Hartford group,
yes, and I probably wasn't the most upstanding student that West Hartford ever saw.
And was this an older sister?
Yes, 2 years older.
Okay.
So then I went off to college, to Providence College, a Dominican college. My mother insisted I go to a Catholic college because I would never go to church when I was at home, and she was going to Mass and communion every Sunday and dragging my dad along. So she said I could transfer in a year knowing I'd be too lazy to do that. And so I went to this Dominican college in Providence, Rhode Island, and buckled down and did fairly well. At the end of those 4 years, I determined I didn't want to get married because I didn't know anybody that I wanted to marry. And
what did you study?
I have had a history major and an economics minor. And everyone was going off to be insurance agents because New England was the insurance capital of the world, and especially Hartford. And I couldn't see myself as an insurance agent, and I couldn't see myself being married. So I applied to law school, which was always a dream of my father's. I thought I might want to try to do something to please him. And I went on to Catholic University in Washington, D.C., which is the same law school that Justice Steinman went to. And I had a great first year.
How did you select that?
I applied to Georgetown Catholic University and Fordham. I was accepted at all of them, but Catholic University gave me a partial scholarship. And my father was looking at retiring within a year or two, and so it was necessary that I get some money. And so I went there and had a wonderful first year. I don't remember studying very much, but I knew where every party in town was. And
What year are we in here?
Where am I?
Who was in the White House?
This is 1963. We're talking about the Kennedy era.
Uh-huh.
And I learned that a young student that dressed appropriately could get into any officer's club because they think he was a young officer, and the drinks were 25 cents a piece and all the food was free. So I would take all my dates to the officers' clubs, and everybody loved me in law school because I could tell them where all the parties were. So it came exam time, and I was quite concerned that I probably hadn't put enough time into this. So what I would do is I asked the smartest people in our class, those people I considered the smartest people in our class, if I could borrow their class notes at night after they went to bed. So what I would do is I'd just play basketball during the day and take some naps, and I'd get their class notes about midnight and study until 9 o'clock in the morning when they came back for their notes. And lo and behold, I came in third in my class. So they wouldn't loan me the notes anymore for that year, so I had to do my own studying. And as law school was coming to an end, Vietnam was out there, and I didn't want to go to Vietnam. So I decided, I was asked if I would continue on for a PhD in international law and relations. This professor I had in law school was starting an institute at Catholic University and offered me a full ride. And I said, I'd be glad to do that. And
But before then, what was your focus in law school? Did you have any
I didn't have any focus. There were classes I liked, there were classes I hated. I loved constitutional law, I hated tax. It's that type of thing. So I did all the coursework for my PhD, and I met most of the requirements, at which time it was time to sit down and take my orals and write a dissertation and all that kind of stuff. And the head of the institute came to me and asked me if I would go over to Dunbarton College while I was doing this part and teach, because a professor in the political science department had a heart attack and had died, and it was a small college, and they needed a second person, and he wanted to recommend me for that job. And it sounded like a fun thing to do, so I did that while I lived on the campus at the Catholic University. I at that time met my then wife, Diana, who was going to a school right near Catholic University. It wasn't Dumbarton, but it was a better school whose name I don't remember right now. It was Trinity, I believe. And I started to teach, and I liked teaching. Get up in front of a bunch of class, and you can have fun. And I set down some rules, like the young women would often come to their first class in raincoats, meaning they hadn't bothered getting dressed yet. And I told them if I was going to get dressed and come to class, they had to get dressed and come to class. And after a person cut a class three times, you were supposed to fail them, and I told them they never had to come to class if they didn't want to. But for every class they'd missed, they'd have to write a 10-page research paper with footnotes on the topics we covered that day. So everybody showed up for class. And I did that, and then the next year, the head of the department left to become the head of the General Accounting Office in Europe. And so at 29, I was made chairman of the political science department, the youngest chairman of the political science department that I know of. In the meantime, Catholic University was in a big fight with this professor who was running the institute, and they wanted to meld the institute back into the Department of Political Science. Well, I didn't want a PhD in political science. It didn't do a lawyer any good to have a PhD in political science. So I was a named party in a lawsuit to the university. I sued them with his money and all his
back. Snowden versus Catholic U?
I was on the list, and I did sue them, and we lost in the District Court of Appeals on a 2-1 verdict. And that case 10 years later would have been won because I had all kinds of lawyers from Washington, D.C. testifying that a degree in international law relations would have been much more valuable to me in their law firm than something in political science. So I think the academic changes after that would have made it so I would have won. But Dumbarton, I thought, was coming to an end. Catholic girls' schools were sort of going out of vogue, and it was time for me to move on.
Now, was Dumbarton right in D.C.?
Right in D.C., right off of Connecticut Avenue. And so I made application to the National Academy of Sciences, which is an institution established by President Lincoln. It's a quasi-independent group that gives advice to the government and other institutions on very important matters. You'll hear them quoted often at a National Academy study. And what happens is professors come there from prestigious schools and spend 2 or 3 years on sabbaticals and work there. And I was hired as the first administrative associate ever hired at the National Academy of Sciences. I was hired in the Office of Scientific Personnel. And I got to work on the Fulbright program.
Well, were they headed in any particular direction? What attracted you to the...
I needed a job.
And
they hired me. I mean, I've fallen into everything thus far, Alex, and this was just another job that I needed, and they hired me. And I soon found out I was way over my head. They had me writing white papers for conferences of brilliant people all over the world that were going to meet in Prague or something. So I'm spending hours in the library writing white papers for these people, knowing that they probably forgotten more than I'd ever be able to write on these white papers. But I was given the chance to work on the scientific astronaut program, and I helped design the requirements for the scientific astronauts that later flew into space. So that was a fun accomplishment. And but knowing that I was in over my head, I saw this ad in the Washington Post for a court administrator. This was in 1969, possibly. And 1970, maybe. And I applied, and I went there and interviewed, and they in turn hired me.
And you just kind of stumbled into that?
Of course.
No commitment or no particular interest in courts or court administration?
No, I just knew I wanted to get out of the National Academy of Sciences before they learned that I was a lot dumber than I thought I was. So I went there, and it was a circuit court with 9 circuit court judges, the judges of general jurisdiction, in the richest county in the United States at that time, Montgomery County. So I had lived in the richest town, now I was running courts in the richest county in the United States. And they had an elected clerk, an elected state's attorney, and these judges, while appointed, were elected. And there were rumors in the old days that Governor Taz was selling judicial appointments for $50,000 apiece. And nobody got along in the building. And I determined the only way to survive in that position was to keep the clerk of the court and the state's attorney separate. I had to have one of them on my side in every battle that I got in, and I was very good at that. And so I was very successful in this job. I brought about calendar reform, and I got the judges working and fairly with good regimen, and everything was going along well. And Warren Berger decided from the U.S. Supreme Court that he needed federal executives. So he started a federal executive program where...
How long were you there?
I was 2 years at that point in time at Montgomery County, Maryland. And I went and I applied to go to this program. It was like a sabbatical from my job. The court said I could go. And I went to Aspen, Colorado for 9 weeks in the summer for the federal executive program, and had a marvelous time. And I think the paper I wrote was looking at court system as a microcosm of nation states, and how they would fight for power as nation states would at the time, and that was based on work by Hans Morgenthau, who wrote a book on nation states and how they get power and so on and so forth. I thought it would be interesting to look at courts as a microcosm of that. And I came back, and one judge wanted to know what I wrote about, and I didn't like this judge because he was a racist and an anti-Semite, and I wouldn't tell him. I said, "That's really none of your business." And so he was very unhappy with me, but he wasn't very popular anyway, and the presiding judge liked me a lot. And I had met a number of people out at this institute, including a man named Ernest Friesen. Ernie Friesen was very early in the field of court administration. So on my spare time, I would go out and do lectures and workshops with Ernie Friesen and earn some extra money.
Where were you getting, what was the source of your knowledge in court administration besides your 2 years of experience?
9 weeks in Aspen, Colorado. It was a very early field. And
who was the faculty there, do you remember?
Oh, there were all kinds of people. Ernie was the lead, Harvey Solomon, people that you might not know. People would come in, Tom McKay, Danny Klein, the head of the Judicature Society. So people would come in and lecture and so on and so forth. In any event, so I met another person there that was also at this institute named Milo Griffin. And Milo Griffin lived in Fairbanks, Alaska. And the only reason I could think that the court asked me to come up and interview is Milo Griffin went back and said, "This guy is really smart and you should interview him." And he told that to Jay Rabinowitz or someone, and so they asked me to come and interview for this job.
And this was when?
This was in
1973. And the focus of the Aspen Institute was
to train federal court executives
in court administration. Basically. So it was basically an effort on the part of Chief Justice Berger to professionalize the field of court system administration.
That's correct. And it all emanated out of what they call Williamsburg II, which was a major conference where Berger talked about the need for professionals running the federal courts and the need for state courts to organize, and which brought about the creation of the National Center for State Courts. So it all came out of that conference.
So back to Milo Griffin.
Well, I came up and I interviewed, and I had applied for the state court job in Maryland, which had just opened up, and I came up and interviewed for this job. And
any inkling before that about what Alaska was like, what the courts were like,
none.
How the state ran.
I knew it was north. I knew it had a bigger earthquake back in '64. I remember seeing the pictures. I knew it was a unified system. I did look it up. I knew that they'd gone through about 7 court directors, and they'd only been at court since 1959, so I knew they were having problems.
And by this time, you'd also met Boney and...
Oh, I'd met them at a conference, but they didn't know me. I mean, I just... They were just 2 Alaskans. So I walk into this interview room after flying up to Alaska, and...
What time of year?
Spring. So it was light for a lot of hours. Like, if you get out of a bar at 5 in the morning, it was light. And they proceeded to ask me a lot of questions about my background and how much responsibility I had and what size jurisdiction court I ran, because there were, 100,000 people in Montgomery County, and our budget was probably as big as their budget.
Who conducted the interviews?
All 5 justices were there. And at the end of their questions, I told them that I was also there to interview them, because I wasn't sure I wanted this position, that they'd gone through all these people, and I'd like to know why and how this happened, because they just had told me that their budget was frozen, that the legislature had frozen their budget because the last director had I don't want to use the word lied, but at least used incorrect numbers in the budget, and so the legislature went absolutely wild and just froze their budget. The executive branch wasn't speaking to them, and things were in pretty bad shape. So in my interview with them, I said I would only take this job under certain conditions, and those conditions were that, 1, I got a chambers on the same floor they had in the new building that wasn't open yet when it opened up, because if they didn't look at me as an equal, no one else was going to look at me as an equal. Secondly, I was to be paid $2,000 less than a Supreme Court justice, because if I wasn't paid more than anybody else in the system, once again, people in the system would not think I had the authority to do this job. Third, that the only thing they could do was hire and fire me. They had no voice in my staff, that I had complete autonomy over my staff, because I felt I had to hire the people I would need to make this succeed. And then I left and flew home, thinking that was a nice trip. There's no way I'm going to get this job.
What prompted you to make those demands? Was it just an ego trip, or did it have something to do with your vision of the office?
It had to do with what I thought that office had to be to make this court system work. They had to leave it alone, let a professional run it. They had to go back to deciding cases. They had to have faith in the person they were hiring, and they had to symbolically let the rest of the system know that this person was in charge. It was only about a $2,000 pay raise from what I was making. It's not like I was really demanding a lot more money. It was a symbolic thing to me. They had to agree to these things, and it was not, these were not negotiables.
Remind us who the court was at this time.
Jay Rabinowitz was Chief Justice. Bob Bucci was probably the senior justice in age, maybe Fitzgerald was. Jim Fitzgerald was there. Bob Irwin and Roger Connor. And John Diamond was in junior as a senior judge, but he was not at the interview. So I went home quite convinced that it was just a nice trip and I got to see Alaska. I probably wouldn't have given a job to somebody who made those demands of me. But they were desperate, and they called 2 weeks later and said, "We agree. Would you start this summer?" And I said, "That's not really fair to my present court, and I'll come up in the fall. But I will come up for a week in the summer, because I'd like to go over all the personnel rules and the budgets and things and so on and so forth you have." And they said, "That's fine." They fly me up for a week in the summer, and I could start in September. And I did come up, and I found out there weren't any such documents. They didn't have any personnel rules. Their budget was a very sparse document. There were no manning charts. There was nothing that I could see. I had a blank slate. Nobody had done anything. And I found this hard to believe. This is 1973. I don't think administration really got up and running until 1960, but it's 13 years after statehood. The Department of Administration is running their personnel system. The Department of Transportation is building buildings. I don't know, other departments were performing other functions. And so the court was really being treated as a department of the executive branch of government, and had no idea what it was doing. It had no real records.
Anything particular that prompted you to come up here and take the job, besides the fact that you got what you wanted?
Well, yes, the only thing that prompted me to take this job, I wanted to run a state court. I thought that was the next progression, and I called up the Chief Justice of Maryland when I got back, Bob Murphy, who was a wonderful gentleman, and I told Bob that I'd been offered this job and that I would prefer the Maryland job, and I wanted to know where I stood on the run. And he said, Art, you're number two on my list. I want John Atkins, who's a very well-known man in the state, a brilliant man, had gone to Harvard and was well-known in the bar. But if he doesn't take it, and he wasn't sure he would, that he wanted to hire me, but he wanted to tell me that he wanted John. And I said, you know, I really appreciate your candor. I'll send you a postcard from Alaska. Packed up my family, my wife and my one-year-old daughter, and we moved to Alaska, essentially. Then I started putting in 15-hour days trying to get things done. I met with all the people who worked here, and I told them that I really didn't care whether they were thought to be the best employees that were ever here or the worst, because with me, they were a blank slate, and their tenure here would depend on how they performed in the future. I proceeded from that basis. A couple of months later, I told the court I thought I was going to look around and hire a deputy. And Jay Rabinowitz looked at me and said, well, we didn't agree to that. And I looked at him and I said, when I took this job at the interview, I thought we'd all made it clear that I hired and fired my own staff and these were my decisions. Jay looked at me and he said, we both lied a lot during that interview, Arthur. So,
what was your relationship with the court in your first months there?
Well, that was a crisis time. Jay, when I came up, was still trying to run the courts. I mean, basically, Jay wanted to know everything that was happening, and he wanted me to hire this person to do this job, and so on and so forth. It was a crisis time, and I don't think he thought that I was the person for the job. I remember right after I got up here, we went out to Kotzebue, and we were going to go to Sedgwick and Kiana. It was October, and I wore a trench coat, and we got a 3-foot snowstorm while we were there, and he just figured, you know, this kid from the East, he didn't even know how to dress to go out to Kotzebue. But I didn't think it would be a huge snowstorm in October in Kotzebue. It's never crossed my mind, and I was still calling Chief Justice. I still had the East Coast manners, and he kept saying, call me Jay. Our relationship at first, that first few months, I wouldn't say was very strong. And I told him after he made that comment about my deputy, and he continued to, in a sense, try to run the administrative side of the court. And I thought as Chief Justice, he should be deciding cases of great importance because most of this Constitution has still not been interpreted or annotated in any way. And my job was to run the courts. So I told him I was thinking of returning to Maryland because my job was still open and they would welcome me back with open arms, which is true, they would. And he said, what do you drink? And I said, scotch. And he said, well, why don't we get together after work? And we drank that bottle of scotch. And we came to an understanding that he would go back to being Chief Justice and I would run the courts. And if I didn't run them well, that we would go along with our first bargain, he would fire me. I said, that was the way I thought it should be. And so I started preparing for the first legislative session. knowing that the budget's frozen, nobody down there likes them, that the governor's mad at them, and I didn't have many documents to work with. And I asked for the upcoming budget, and I went through it line by line, and every typo, every addition error that I found in it, I circled a big red crayon and sent it back to let the people, not my staff, know, A, I do read their work, and B, sloppiness isn't acceptable, especially when we're going down to be in front of a legislature that doesn't like us. Two things happened that year. One, there were a spate of bills that were very anti-court, many of them probably unconstitutional, some of them written by judges on our trial court, who didn't like the Supreme Court either. And
explain that one. What was the court system like from your perception, just the judicial part of it? How many judges were where, and were there camps? How did it look to you?
There were about four in Fairbanks who didn't speak to each other, for the most part. They didn't get along. There was one in Juneau. There was one in Nome. Kenai, we hadn't opened yet. We had five or six or seven district court judges in Anchorage, I think, and about eight or nine superior court judges. And you know how my mind goes at times. I forget, who was the family court judge back then? Do you remember?
Butcher, Harold Butcher?
Harold Butcher. And the Supreme Court, I was going around to meet these people and said, now, be very wary of Judge Butcher. I mean, he can be quite stern and quite this. And I'm thinking, Judge Butcher should be wary of me, not me wary of him. I'm not going to be wary of Harold Butcher. This is not, if I get down there, you know, with my hat in the hand of Harold Butcher, I'm dead before I even start. So I went down there. I was polite to him and all the other judges I met, but I certainly treated them as fellow professionals. Not that I should have anything to fear from them or that I was afraid of them. So it was that type of atmosphere that the Supreme Court was even worried about Harold Butcher, which I couldn't understand. But as I say, some judges downstairs had helped with legislation that was put into the House that was really limited to the Supreme Court, and some was very unconstitutionally harsh type of legislation. And it had been pre-filed, and I knew about it, and the court knew about it, and the court wanted me to oppose it. And the court generally doesn't take a position on legislation, but that's how drastic some of this legislation was. At the same time, Jay asked me if I would get them a pay raise. And I said, that's not part of my job description as far as I know. And he said, yeah, they haven't had a pay raise in a long time, and they really would like one, and would I try to get them a pay raise? And so we made another bargain. I would try to get them a pay raise, but no judge was allowed to come to Juneau to testify on that pay raise or anything else without my permission. I didn't want any judge help. I didn't want any judges down there. They didn't like judges. And he said, okay. So off I went to Juneau. Not knowing a thing about how you got along with the state legislature.
So this was the beginning of the year in 74.
That's correct. And I ran into a number of people, but one person that immediately comes to mind, he was a great influence in my early tenure in Juneau, was a man named Clem Tillion, who was known to be very, very conservative. He was type of person would say we could save a lot of money if we just went from police to corrections and just cut out the middleman here. And but he liked me, and his wife Diana liked me, and they had me over for dinner every night when I was down there. And I testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee for at least three solid weeks, day after day, on this spate of bills. And at the same time, I'm trying to move a pay raise through the Senate, which is a whole different story. But at the end of all these hearings, at dinner one night, Clem said, Art, pick the bill that's least objectionable to you. All the rest will go in my draw. and that was the only one that will pass out of my committee. So I did that. So that problem was then taken care of for the court, because those bills weren't going anywhere. And then I started working on the pay raise. Cliff Grill was the president of the Senate at that time. And I think Bill Ray was chairman of the Finance Committee, and he was a very gruff person. And I went and testified for a sizable pay raise. I think it was about a $10,000 pay raise for the court at that time. And so, you know, it was about a 25% pay increase. And the governor had, at the same time, he was running for re-election, he had a pay raise in for judges of about 4%. So there was a bit of difference between where the governor was and where we were. And I testified, and I thought I testified very effectively on the need for a pay raise, not realizing it doesn't matter how effective I was, that I probably wasn't going to get it. And so they voted to go with the governor's bill, and I looked at the Rick Barrier, who was on my staff with me, and I said, oh, shit. And we walked out. I got a frenzied call from Cliff Grill within about an hour saying a senator on the committee, a senator named Sackett, said I had sworn at the committee, and I needed to write a letter of apology to the committee. And I said, I didn't swear at the committee. I basically looked at my assistant and was discouraged, and I said, oh shit, excuse my language, but that's all I said. And I said, I'd like you to call the committee back into order. He said, I wouldn't do that if I were you. And I said, please. He said, okay. So he called the committee back into order, and I sat down and I proceeded to apologize if they thought I swore at them, that I didn't. It was more of an expression of despair to my colleague, and I sincerely apologized, and I looked at Senator Sackett and I said, and I especially want to apologize to you, Senator Sackett. I walked out, making myself one of the biggest enemies in the legislature.
Why did you do that?
Because he lied to them, and he put me in a very bad position in my first year, and I wasn't about to back down to him.
Okay.
And I left, and the bill that we had introduced in the Judiciary Committee, as I said, didn't go out of finance. The finance version that was Bill Egan's version went out. And one day I got a call from Willie Hensley, and he said, I just want to make sure that the magistrates are taken care of under this bill. And I said, no, Willie, they're not. They're in our regular budget. They're not included in the judicial pay raise. But Willie, would you be willing to vote for the judiciary version of that bill? He said, yeah, I think I might be willing to do that. And I called Cliff, and Cliff said he could try to round up a few votes for the judiciary version. And I talked to Tom Stewart, and Tom went over and talked to Terry Miller. The judiciary chair. Terry Miller was president of the Senate, and Terry liked me. And so when the bill came up to the floor, Cliff Grill quickly stood and made a motion that the judiciary version of the bill be moved to the floor, not the finance. And the place broke loose. There was pandemonium. They had to call a timeout, and finally came back and took a vote. And I won 11-9 for the Senate on 11-9 vote, and went over to the House. And Earl Freeman was the finance chair of the House that time. And he told me he would pass our bill out if the Senate was crazy enough to allow these new union pay raises, that because he thought they shouldn't bother the unions and the new unions, and he felt that set a terrible precedent. So if they passed the union pay raise, my bill would get passed out. And the Senate passed the union pay raise, so he passed my bill out and went to rules. At which point in time, the governor notified Dick McVeigh, who was the rules chairman, that he would veto the bill. And Dick said, well, then I'm not going to let the employees raise the pay raise bill out of my rules committee. and the governor's running for a re-election, he wanted the employees bill. So the governor reluctantly agreed that he would let the judge's pay raise go through. So I both got them a pay raise and killed all this bad legislation, all by sheer luck in my first year, and I thought I was a genius. But in truth, I was just very lucky, and circumstances happened to create that set of things to come together. And then once I had a budget, I bet the person who froze our budget the year before, a House member named Frank Ferguson, who I became very friendly with, he made it clear to me he wasn't against the court, he just thought that budget was terrible, and I gave him my commitment that no budget would ever come in again that had double budgeting as long as I was director of the court. And so he became a friend of mine. The session ended and I came back and I started building a staff. I kept the people I thought were good and I started weeding people out and hiring other people.
Let me stop you at this point. So this is your past your first legislative session, still in your first year as administrative director.
That's cool.
And it seems to me you're describing a job that involved two things. The first was being administrative director of the court system, and the second was being in Juneau and getting the legislature to do what the court system wanted. Did you expect that to be the case?
Yes, I knew that was part of the job. I knew that going to Juneau was part of the job. Did I expect the legislature not to be a wise body who would see the wisdom of common sense? No, I expected that they were, you know, the elected officials who would be trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, did you not experience lobbying or being with just a legislative group before?
Just the county commissioners in Montgomery County, you know, and they generally didn't mess around with the budget because the judges' salaries were paid by the state, so they really only had to pay jury expenses and keeping upkeep of the building, that type of thing. So, no, this was my first experience. It turned out well. The judges were delighted that I got them such a big pay raise. They were delighted that I killed all this legislation, and they thought that they might have hired the right person. But as I say, it was all just fortuitous. I didn't know what I was doing. But I am a quick learner, and I started. I told the department administration we weren't going to use the personnel rules anymore. We were drawing our own that fit the needs of the court because they were very bureaucratic. I told them that, as far as I was concerned, they had no say in our budget anymore. They had told a prior administrative director he couldn't buy donuts for the jurors, and there was this little agreement that got written up saying that he could buy donuts for the jurors. So I said that wasn't going to happen anymore, and then I went to the court. By this time, Jay was no longer chief. So he had been in his last year, and Bob Boutier had been elected chief. And Bill Egan, even though he had paved the road in Juneau and got the employees a pay raise, lost the election by a few hundred votes to an ex-president of the Senate, a fairly unknown man named Jay Hammond, who was a very close friend of Clem Tillion. And Clem told me that he was going to win, and it introduced me to this man, Jay Hammond. And he was a very engaging man, a very, very, very nice man. I immediately liked him. And I came back and I told the court that we had to not give the governor our budget, because what the court had done is, like all departments, they'd given the court budget to the governor, and then he would cross out things he didn't like before he gave it to the legislature. And I said, he can't do that. We're not a department. And the court was very concerned about trying to change the status quo. And I said, we have a new governor. If we're going to change it, now is the time that we have to go and change that. And I had hired as my staff attorney a public defender named Susan Burke. And I had Susan Burke write up a legal brief on why the executive branch couldn't cut our budget. And I had met the new attorney general, Avram Gross. He was 36, I was 33. Herb Soles in his 30s, he was the public defender, so it was a very young leadership in the criminal justice area. And Adam and I got along very well, and I told him what I was going to do and why. And I asked.
And so your basic position was that the court system is a third branch of government, not an executive branch agency.
A third co-equal branch of government, yes. And the court very reluctantly agreed to that the Chief Justice and I and Susan would go down and meet with the governor and Abram and discuss this with him. And so an appointment was made, and we went in, and Governor Hammond said hello to all of us, and he said, and Bob, what can I do for you? And Bob said, Art wants to talk to you. Governor looked at me, and I said, Governor, I really just came to tell you that we're not going to give you our budget anymore on submission, because every time we've given our budget to the executive branch on submission, they've changed it. And I don't think that the executive branch has that authority. It really means you're setting the judiciary's priorities. And I don't see where you are losing anything by us not submitting the budget, because you have a line item veto power. You can veto anything you don't like when this budget gets out of the legislature. So I don't see anything where this diminishes your power in one way or the other. And the governor looked at me, and he looked at Ab, and he said, can they do this? And Abram looked back at the governor, and he said, it's a very close question, Governor, but we need to remember one thing. And Governor Hammond said, what's that, Ab? And he said, it's going to be decided in their courtroom. So Jay is very quick, and he said, would you give me the budget if I don't comment on it? And I said, I'll give you 100 budgets if you don't comment on it. And that's how we started establishing ourselves as a third branch of government. And the legislature, when they heard this, went crazy. Who do you think you are? Bill Ray was yelling at me in the hallway. Everybody else's budget gets submitted to the governor and can get changed. And I said, do you submit yours, Senator Ray? Do they cut yours? We're different. I said, so are we. But it took the legislature 2 or 3 years to get used to that. I mean, it really was not something they readily accepted. Eventually, they did accept it. At the same time, two buildings were getting ready to be opened at the Department of Transportation and Facilities was building. One was in Kenai, and the other one was in Valdez. And I asked to look at the plans, and they refused to show me the plans. And I said, I want to see the plans, and if I don't see the plans, we won't move into the buildings, and you'll have two empty buildings on your hands. And I talked to the court about this. And the court was now getting the idea that we were going to have to be doing things differently. And they backed me up on this. I mean, I never went to the governor or anything. I mean, just the commissioner. And finally, they trudged over and showed me the plans, and I said, these are unacceptable. You don't know how to design court buildings. I brought some of the judges in and talked about the need to keep jurors separate from the public and prisoners that couldn't be walking through the main floors and everything like that. But the buildings were almost done. So an agreement was made that I could bring in an architect and we could make what changes that could be made within the structural boundaries of the buildings as they stood then. And I hired Mike Wong, who was a specialist in court design, and brought Mike in to do what he could on those buildings. So that was the last time we ever allowed the executive branch to build a building for us. From then on, we started building our own buildings. I hired an architect on our staff, and we hired, and we went out to public bid and started building our own buildings. Never did any of our buildings come in over budget, as was not true when they were under the Department of Transportation. They always were over budget. So we took that away from the executive branch. Money was starting to flow into the state. They had the $900 million from the oil set lease sale. There was money coming in income tax because of all the workers on the pipelines. So the state was finally getting to the point where they had money to do things. And I decided it would be a good time, if they want to judge the courts, that they would that the legislature and the executive branch should judge us only as a court, because that's what we were. And so it was time to get rid of a few functions that I didn't think were judicial in nature. One of those was the recording function. Most of the recording in the state was under the court system. And I went to the court and I said, I don't think we should be taking care of land records and these types of things, and I'm going to get rid of them. Do you see any problem with that? And because I met with the court every week, that was part of our agreement. I felt that every justice on the court should sit in an administrative conference, because anyone could be chief justice at any time, so they all had to be aware of what was happening at all times. So all major policy issues I took before the full court. It wasn't just the chief justice and I deciding something. The minor policy issues I just decided, but the major ones I took to the court. And they said, no, that's fine. Why don't you get down and do that? And Andy Warwick was the commissioner of administration, and he had the UCC filings. And he said, well, I think they should be all together, but they all should be under you. And I said, Andy, why don't we just both put in a bill, and whoever the legislature gives it to will end up doing recording. And Andy said, okay, that sounds fine to me. And we both put in bills. Well, the executive branch is sort of a cumbersome branch of government. They have to have meetings and then more meetings, and then they have to consult with the commissioner, and then they need to consult with the governor's office. And by the time they did that, my bill had passed the Senate 18-2, and it was going to be on the House floor 3 or 4 days from then, and it just flew through the legislature. Dan Omer came up to me and said, I want you to pull that bill. She was the head of the planning for the governor. And I said, why? She said, we don't want that. And I said, neither do I. And she said, I'll have the governor veto that bill if you get it passed. And I said, well, that's fair enough, Fran. And it passed the House 38-2. And I saw Fran. I said, let's see, 18-2 in the Senate, 38-2 in the House. I don't think that you can sustain a veto on that, Fran. And I left. And he didn't veto it. I also had an agreement with the governor that, and he liked me. I'd go over his house and have ice cream with him and Clem. That they would never veto any of our stuff without talking to me. And Frank Ferguson put in a bill for I'm getting ahead of myself. That happened a year later. But I'll do that one. He put in a bill to build a courthouse for us in Barrow. And it passed. And the governor was mad at Frank, so he vetoed it. And nobody had called me. And I went ballistic. Because just that year, they had tied somebody to a fire engine, outside the Barrow courthouse. And we had honey buckets, and it was just a terrible, terrible, terrible facility. And so I talked to the court, and I said, if we allow this, they're never going to talk to us before they veto us. And Kent Dawson was the chief of staff, and he apologized profusely, saying that they didn't know that it was ours. They were just getting back at Frank. And I said, well, it's a courthouse. You might have thought to call. In any event, we're going to start pulling all prisoners down to Fairbanks from now on and trying them there, because the court facility in Barrow should be condemned. It's just in terrible shape. And I know the governor, is counting on the Bush in his next election, but he'll have to explain that to him. Got a call next day that the governor was going to come up with contingency money out of his budget to rent a space in Barrow, fresh new space in Barrow. So we got new space in Barrow. In the meantime, I'm building the office and getting personnel rules, and Chief Justice Boutchever said that he wants every Chief Justice, I asked him what one thing they wanted more than anything else, and he wanted a public information officer, which I thought was a waste of time.
So this is when now?
This is after the second year now. I've gone through
75.
Yeah. So I hired one, but as long as the court wouldn't let the public information officer explain the rationale for their decisions, I didn't see what good a public information officer could do. And the court would never explain the rationale for its decision. They'd say, read the decision. So that didn't seem to go that well, that position. And I was having trouble with the statewide law librarian at the time, too.
It was the press position, was that Jim Babb?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And I was having problems with the statewide law librarian, and I had the court clarify the rules as who were at my at-will employees rather than merit employees, and they clarified those rules, and after which time I called the statewide law librarian up to my office and told her that she served at my pleasure and I was no longer pleased, and so that she was fired. And so she contacted every bar president in the state and started this big campaign, had them, you know, calling up the chief justice and everything, and Bob did not like bad publicity. Bob liked to get along with everybody, and he was a great gentleman. I really have a lot of respect for Bob Bucher, but he didn't like heat. So he called me in and said, why didn't you ask me before you fired the statewide law librarian? And I said, because she's one of my employees and she's an at-will employee, and if you want to rehire her, you can fire me. I was that adamant about that, and he wasn't going to hire me, but he wasn't happy about this. But he got over it, and Ken Jensen came in from the Anchorage bar and sat down and talked to me about it, and he said, I know you wouldn't have done this unless you had the power to do it, so we're going to let it go. I said, thanks, Ken. I'm old, so I forget things. That first year when I got the judges a pay raise, another thing happened that does bear relating. The Bar Association and I had a fight because they weren't supporting the judges' pay raise in Juneau, and they weren't supportive of our program, and I thought that they should be, and they thought that I should be more supportive of them, and I didn't think that was my job. So there was a big meeting between the Supreme Court, the Board of Governors, and me. And it came down to a shouting match between me and the Board of Governors, and the court got up and said, we think we'll leave and let you people hash it out. And the court left.
And left you with the Board of
Governors? Left me with the Board of Governors. About 15 minutes later, Justice Fitzgerald walked back into the room, put a big cigar down in front of me, turned around and walked out. Which pretty much sent the message where the court was going to go on that one. And so the board knew that they were going to have to work with the administrative office. So that set the tone for, and I got along with the board after that, the governors after that. I mean, once the ground rules got laid down, we did get along. So I was not.
It's about an hour into the.
Okay, day. Shall we take a break?
Take a break and we'll come back.
Okay.
Man, you had a lot of battles, my goodness. Tough group of people to work with.
The only way you were going to establish this judiciary was to fight the battles.
Well, yeah, because the.
He comes back as chief, he and I become the best of friends, yeah. And he tells me to go put every magistrate in the bushes
and
support
him. But then what's his name, Sackett?
Oh, that doesn't happen for a while. As long as he's only sitting on the finance committee and he's not the chair, and I had the house in my pocket, basically, the house would fight for my budget, the free conference committee, and I'd get my budget, so, yeah.
We're only in the second.
But this is where we built the system.
Yeah, you've conquered almost everything.
I mean, basically.
You've got the legislature in this name, you've got the court in this name, you've got the bar in shape.
No, now we go to the trial court.
Okay. Now, yeah.
I wasn't dealing, I just didn't deal with him anymore. We had this, I should have talked about this criminal justice committee we set up with me and the attorney general and the public defender and the health and social services and corrections, where we sat down and we tried to solve all our problems and we supported each other in front of the legislature. And I got the public defender their budget almost every year because nobody liked them and they liked me, so I'd go in and get their budget because we couldn't operate unless they could operate. Remember the one year we couldn't get it for them and you...
Don't tell me about it now.
Well, I'm not going to tell them that you called up and I asked you to hold off. That's not getting on this tape.
No. You can tell them that you work for...
There are things I'm not going to say, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say Bob Irwin quit in a state of anger because the Cheever became justice.
We'll be here on that. I'll be right back because I'm going to go to the...
There's one in here.
Oh, is there? Oh. Yeah. Listen. Found that bottle of wine.
He did?
Yeah.
Well, I'll bring it back up. Just in case it's gone bad.
It is a Caymus.
It is a Caymus?
You know what year it is.
You sure you don't want to save it?
You don't know. No. You know what year it is?
78. 80.
85.
85.
85. Is that a good year?
Yeah. 85 is a good year for Caymus. Caymus is like Silver Rope. They're at the same levels. Better in some years. So yeah, probably a great bottle of wine. You might want to put it on eBay.
Why?
I don't know what it's worth. Might be worth $300-$400. I don't know. I bought some bottled wine last year, so that's from 1997 Heights.
Is there anything on the internet where you can price wine like that?
Probably. We'll try to look it up. I'll probably do what I do now.
Google it.
Yeah,
go ahead. No,
well, not if we drink it.
Well, we can still look it up. It's how much we drank out.
I bought a case of wine last year from Heights, the Bella Oaks Cab, 97. And I bought a case of it, $50-something a bottle. And I went to the Benson Hotel for dinner, because they got the biggest wine list. Looked it up from there, wine. It was $220 at the restaurant. So I got a whole case of that stuff. I ordered another 6 bottles of it. It's like 18 bottles. I've been drinking it. I probably have about 10 bottles left. But I've got some wines that were given to me by Neil that are in the ones 1978 wines. I think it's French. I've got something in the 1985, the Spanish wine that gave me. I have some old bottles of them. I'm not very good anymore. I keep them cool and I rotate them once in a while, but. Anyway, is this the kind of stuff you want to talk about, or you want to talk about other stuff?
You're the one who's talking.
I know.
You're the one. I do want to sort of tie some things together. All
right.
And
I'm just trying to lay the foundation of how you became a third branch of government.
No, you're definitely well on the way to doing that.
Because I honestly don't think you ever would have become a third branch of government unless somebody did something like that. Everybody was used to the way it was.
Yeah, yeah. And in a lot of states, it hasn't happened.
No. Well, I don't know. We have elected judges that sort of have. But, I think California's done a good job. I mean, they unified their trial court system under the states in the last 10 years, and I thought that was almost impossible.
But and they have an incredibly complicated system.
Yeah.
Fragmented.
But Bill Vickery was able to pull that off. I give him all the credit in the world. Stephanie thinks he's sort of blowhardness. Stephanie, this guy took these disparate trial courts that were funded by patchwork counties and so on and so forth, unified them under the state in California. Doesn't that sound like he's a little bit capable to you? He's a very bright guy.
He has some odd notions about things.
I mean, I don't think I would have been able to do that in California. But Ralph Klebs, who I greatly admired in California, was not very able to pull that off. Because you have all these power bases, like
yeah.
L.A., you know, a huge power base. So pull that off with something special. Anyway, just let me define, take about 2 minutes to define the boundaries of the court system, is whatever I was going. That's the next thing I'm going to do.
What do you mean?
For example, I'm going to now tell you that the things we got rid of so we would just be looked at as a judiciary, and also to control.
Okay, boundaries in that way, okay.
Uncontrollable costs. Like the next thing
okay.
I did is get rid of trial judges appointing conflict attorneys, created OPA. And then I got rid of the magistrates as coroners and created the medical examiner all outside the judicial branch. And they're all uncontrollable. You don't know how many poor people are going to get arrested. You don't know how many people are going to file land deeds. You don't know how many people are going to die. So there's a budget item that you can't control. So I wanted to get rid of them. And the executive branch had a lot of money at that time, and they didn't mind taking them. Since then, they want to give them back.
All
right. Righty. Back.